Good morning, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, here from the third day of the ITB, and actually from our fifth edition of our little podcast here from ITB, which is called Beyond Business. I'm very happy to have a guest today that is not an expert on tourism so much.
Well, but I've traveled a lot, I have to say.
But on subjects that are even more important to mankind than holidays, we can put it that way. Welcome, Dr. Frauke Fischer, an acclaimed biologist and expert on biodiversity. Great having you here. Thanks a lot for coming to ITB. To give a little introduction about you, you studied biology in Frankfurt and in the US. After graduation, you spent 10 years at the Ivory Coast as a researcher in a national park, leaving the country after the breakout of a civil war. But beyond being a biologist and an expert on biodiversity, you're also a very active communicator about your topics, not only publishing in the science community, but also to a broader audience. You have written a book with a title which is called What Did the Mosquitoes Do for Us?
What has the mosquito ever done for
us? What have they ever done for us? And maybe we can talk about that later, what the mosquitoes have done for us or actually are still doing for us. But to start with your experience as a field researcher and as a biologist, you studied the antelopes in the Ivory Coast. And why are they endangered? Or what's the situation of antelopes in the Ivory Coast? To start with something very precise and concrete.
Yeah. Antelopes are, as unfortunately many wildlife species in Africa, considered food. So people hunt them. And the challenge or the problem is that there are more and more people, there are more and more efficient weapons, firearms, and that the increasing population hunts increasingly on a decreasing wildlife population. And the idea of my PhD was actually to find out ways how a sustainable way of hunting outside protected areas could be beneficial to the local people, but also help to increase or at least not to deplete any further the antelope populations. Then when I got there, I unfortunately had to realize that the national park I was working in, the Komoé National Park in Côte d'Ivoire, was a pure paper park. So it existed only on paper. And there was a lot of hunting within the park. And people actually hunted more inside the park than outside, because when they hunted outside, they were had always discussions with other land stewards, like farmers, for example. A lot of kids worked on these farms, and the farmers didn't want the hunters to run around with their guns among the kids. And then, of course, the wildlife populations outside the national park were already very much depleted. So that increased the pressure on the park. And the problem when we, in terms of tourism, for example, means that, or the problem that is created by this overhunting wildlife populations is that the tourism potential, of course, dramatically sinks. I mean, the park I was working in traditionally, historically, had elephants, lions, rhinos, wild dogs, cheetah, everything. And these wildlife populations were very much depleted already. And this, of course, decreases, the potential of such areas as tourism destinations.
What's it like living in a rainforest or in a national park, like in the Ivory Coast? Is it comparable to a tourist experience?
No.
Completely different from that.
Completely different. Yeah, well, the park is, it's a savanna national park, and our camp, a very basic research camp, very traditional straw huts, actually, no sanitary facilities, no toilet, no showers, nothing. So we had to drink filtered water from the river. We actually swam in the river with the hippos and the crocodiles, which we could do because the crocodiles obviously were specialized fish hunters. They weren't interested in mammals such as us. This river flew about more than 200 kilometers through uninhabited land, so there wasn't the danger of catching any diseases. So, yeah, but our life was very, very simple. We produced our own electricity with little solar panels. There was no toilets, no showers. Once or twice a month, we went to a city to buy food. So at the first days, we had fruit salad and and cheese and stuff like this. And after a week, there was only rice and tomato sauce, for example.
Okay, so that was a way of life you could never, ever sell to a tourist. As a tourist product.
Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, the only tourists that visited the park were actually the people from the German embassy. They found it quite interesting to visit this German research station. And for them, it was like a super adventure, swimming in the river, no air condition, no, I don't know, cold drinks at in the evening, no cocktails or anything. For them, it was like a super adventure. And they were very enthusiastic tourists, but only for 2 or 3 days. So
of course,
I think you can probably sell it as a once-in-a-lifetime experience, but not so much as a kind of a luxury, relaxing tourism experience.
I mean, as I know from the Ivory Coast is a country that relies heavily on agriculture and is a large producer of cocoa, for example.
Yeah.
I think even the largest in the world in exporting. So you have these big, big plantation cultures, and they are eating away the wildlife.
Yes.
And they're destroying the wildlife. And looking at all that, I mean, placing a global industry like agriculture in contrast to tourism, which is also a global industry, would you say which is more dangerous for wildlife and for biodiversity, or is this comparison which doesn't make sense?
If we look at the, there are five drivers of biodiversity loss, and the largest driver is actually land use change, and most of this is done for agriculture. So if we look at this scale, we can say definitely the, well, Ivory Coast, for example, in the long term, they would have been much, much better off if they would have focused on tourism, not on monocultures of cocoa. Because what happens now, you're right, they are the largest producer of cocoa, but they, with these monocultures, they now have, the soil is depleted, there's an increase in diseases and pests because it's monoculture, so it's a haven for a certain, for pests and disease. So the production of cocoa now might come to an end in Côte d'Ivoire. And that's terrible because this is the only product they sell. And with the increase of cocoa production, they have destroyed all their other natural resources. There's no rainforest, there are no elephants left, there are very, very few chimps there, even in the savannah region, and at least in the transition zone between rainforests and savannas, they destroyed an entire national park to produce cocoa. So if this now comes to an end, well, there's little alternatives. And if we look at the long-term benefit of tourism, especially when it's sustainable tourism, then a sustainable wildlife tourism would have been possible eternally. So if you look at short-term revenues, it, well, we can say that the destruction of the basis of life for many makes a few rich. If you look at the long-term tourism, if it's if it's sustainable tourism, it's much, much better, a better decision.
Yeah, I mean, if I would be an economic advisor from, let's say, the World Bank or something, I would rather recommend to those countries rather invest in sustainable sort of nature tourism than agricultural plantations and export production.
Yeah.
Is this what you would basically agree with?
Definitely. Especially because we now see new markets. We see, for example, markets for payment for ecosystem services. And if you look at natural ecosystems, they provide all of us with a lot of ecosystem services, such as clean air, clean water, fertile soils, pollination services, etc. So, and we now see an emerging market in these payments for ecosystem services. So in the future, if you have a healthy ecosystem, it might be a coral reef, a mangrove, a rainforest, a savanna, you might not only be able to sell it as a tourist destination, but at the same time, you might make money with selling ecosystem services. And that's something only natural ecosystems can do.
When you look at the mentality of the decision makers in these countries, let's say the Ivory Coast, because you might be familiar with it, you still change in mentality, or you see openness at the, with the politicians and the other decision makers about this kind of strategy?
Well, unfortunately, we see little of this. And I think one of the saddest history, I just have to mention this because in our own podcast, which is about animals and nature conservation, we were talking about Madagascar. Madagascar is absolutely unique when you look at the wildlife it has. It's the only country in the world where you can see lemurs, where you can, it has absolutely unique ecology, absolutely unique ecosystems. Today, there are people starving in Madagascar. All the forest is gone, people becoming more and poorer and poorer. And that's actually based on terrible political decisions. And the same is true for Ivory Coast. I mean, you said that we had to leave when the Civil War broke out. And there were scientific analysis of this. And people actually said, or scientists found out, that the main driver for the outbreak of the Civil War was the depletion of natural resources. Because then people start to attack each other. A couple of weeks ago, the UK Secret Service, the government, published a report on security, global security, or mainly security for the EU and the UK in relation to ecosystem services. And it's not a publication by an NGO, it's a publication by a secret service of a country, in this case UK, and they say the biggest security risk for UK and the EU is the depletion of ecosystem services, because this will, and they show this quite clearly, this will increase organized crimes, this will increase terrorism, it will increase conflicts within and between countries. So everybody who wants to think about tourism and economy in the future, not only tourism, but all economy in the future, should focus on the protection of ecosystem services. And this is not only true for governments in Côte d'Ivoire or Madagascar, it's also true for European governments. And then it's very sad to hear that hardly we talk about this issue, even though it's considered to be actually our biggest challenge.
You were joining the ITB Congress and you were in a session some minutes ago and speaking in front of a large audience. You spoke also about AI and the role of AI. I don't want to talk about AI so much. I want to talk about the more basic things. And what is the basic message you want to give to an industry like tourism? And do you think that tourism, can they have an impact for the better? Can they do something? Yeah. Or what's the basic message you want
to
spread?
I think they definitely can do something. First, people that engage, people that visit each other, hopefully won't kill each other. So I think this is a very important argument for tourism, that people get to know people from other countries, other cultures, people that speak other languages, have other beliefs. So I think, increasing global friendship in a way is a very important aspect of tourism. Then when we look at many, many forms of tourism, to them, intact nature is the asset they want to sell. If you want to have divers in the Maldives, you have to have intact coral reefs or intact mangroves. If you want to have people visiting South Africa or East Africa, you have to have the Big Five in healthy populations. If you want to have people visiting the Amazon, well, there should be a healthy rainforest there. So, yeah, unfortunately, with the destruction of nature, the possibilities where you can actually go to see intact natures are reduced. And this eventually will lead to the destruction of our economy, the collapse of our economy. And of course, the economic sector that will lose first, it will be tourism. So if people want other people to travel, if you want to sell tourism as a product, if you want to sell destinations as a product, ecosystems have to be healthy, ecosystem services have to be in place.
Yeah, I think the message is clear, but the way, how we can we achieve it, it might be more complicated and more difficult. I mean, as far from what I know from the industry, you have a lot of people who are dedicated and really devoted to sustainability and to nature protection. But on the other hand, you also have this tendency of greenwashing, which you can see in many places and which is only for a facade of things.
Yeah.
And so what would be the strategy? What would be the action plan?
Yeah, I think it's a lot about, I mean, you mentioned that one of my major tasks in these days is communication. It's what I do. I'm a professor at the university. I'm talking to C-level people in the economy. I talk to as many people as possible about the importance of biodiversity and ecosystem services. So you mentioned there are people dedicated and they have to raise their voices because they are the ones that understand sustainability in tourism are the ones who understand the business, while those who think, well, just take, make, waste, and well, that's not going to work. It used to work, but it's not going to work anytime longer. So, and I think very often people think, okay, there are these guys, they are doing the real business, and then there are those who do sustainability. But actually, we can say in the future, you either have a sustainable business model or you don't have a business at all. So I think there should be much more pride in saying, I am a sustainability person, I'm a nature person protecting biodiversity and ecosystem services, because these are the real heroes.
Would you say that the whole issue of biodiversity gets too little attention compared to the whole climate change discussion? And biodiversity is a completely different, well, it's both connected, but it's not so much on the focus like climate change.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I mean, to say something quite provocative, climate change is not our problem. If climate change increases or accelerates, the question is, if we don't if we don't deal seriously with the loss of biodiversity and ecosystem services, climate change will only decide if it's a little bit warmer or a little bit colder when we go extinct. And before we go extinct, our economy will collapse. Our social systems, everything will collapse. So we really, really have a very high interest in doing something about it. And of course, it's important to fight climate change. But actually, the most economic way to do it is to invest in intact nature and restore as much nature as possible. Because nature is the best way, for example, to sequester carbon. You know, it's much better to have a blue whale, a 100-year-old blue whale that contains, I don't know, 15 tons of carbon, than to invest in carbon storage somewhere in the soil or whatever. So, the best way to fight climate change is investing in nature, protecting nature, restoring nature. That's the best way to fight climate change.
At the end of our little podcast conversation here, we need to talk about the mosquito, which you mentioned in your book. And I remembered I had an interview with a colleague of yours, and he also worked in the Ivory Coast, Mr. Christopher Bush.
Oh, yeah.
He died.
Yeah, he was one of the most famous chimp researchers.
Yeah, he spent 20 years with these chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. And he said in that interview, the biggest tragedy or a real problem of today's life is that humans only care for humans. Humans are only interested in humans. We watch movies about humans. We read books about, and the animals are far back behind that. Mm-hmm. That's now the time where we need to talk about the mosquito. Why should we care about the mosquito? You give a little.
Well, the answer is quite simple. And it actually go back to Ivory Coast and the cocoa. Mosquitoes are the most important pollinators for cocoa. So if there wouldn't be mosquitoes, there won't be any chocolate. So I think that's a very simple answer. Without mosquitoes, there won't be any chocolate. And this hopefully convinces many people that we need to protect the mosquito.
Because only this special type of
mosquito. Yeah, the flowers are very, very tiny. The cocoa flowers are very tiny. So many people think, well, but honeybees are the good pollinators. But honeybees are much, much too large to enter the flower of a cacao flower. So you have to have tiny, tiny pollinators. And the major pollinators, the main pollinators of cacao, are actually two species of mosquitoes.
And that's only one little example of the many connections between biodiversity.
And maybe I just one last word, because you mentioned AI and what Christoph Bösch said then back then. AI might help us to better understand animals in the pure sense. So chimps communicate with each other, whales communicate with each other, elephants communicate with each other, and AI, which is very good in finding difference or analyzing patterns, might help us to understand what they're actually saying to each other. And this will hopefully, for many people, bring animals closer to them. And for example, when it was published that whales have whale songs, there was a huge public interest in stopping whaling. Because people realize, well, these are not stupid animals. These are animals, they sing, they communicate. That's one of the examples where we hope that AI helps us to protect nature.
And to improve our knowledge about animals and biodiversity and to learn faster about what it's all about.
Yeah.
This is such a great topic, and we could go on with this.
Well, we're sitting in this perfect studio, so.
for maybe one more hour and not running out of issues and topics, but this is a business show, basically, ITB, so everybody's in a rush and everybody's rushing to the next appointment. You told me you have to catch your train to Frankfurt. So, Dr. Frauke Fischer, it was a pleasure having you. It was very interesting. And I hope we can spread the message.
Yes.
We will care about the mosquitoes and all these other beautiful creatures on this planet. Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you.